Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. You have most likely heard these statistics. 1 in 5 women have been raped in their lifetime. That breaks down to nearly 22 million women in the United States. While the vast majority of sexual assault survivors are women, men are also at risk. 1 in 71 men will have been raped during their lives. That's about 1.6 million men. Nearly half of female survivors were raped before they were 18, and over 1/4 of male survivors before they were just 10. The problem is particularly acute on college campuses. According to a Washington Post Kaiser Family Foundation study, 20% of young women and 5% of men who attended college during the past 4 years say they were sexually assaulted. Most survivors know the person who raped them. The majority of perpetrators, 98%, are male. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about effective anti-rape education for boys and men. What is most effective when it comes to countering rape culture in a way that speaks to young men? And what are we telling boys and young men about sex and consent? Today, we are joined by Andres Montiliano, Executive Director of Community Violence Solutions. Andres has nearly 20 years of experience working with survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault. And Andres joins us on the line from San Pablo. Hi, Andres. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us. We're also joined by Adrian Valdivia, Manager of National Programs for Men Can Stop Rape. Adrian was a recipient of the organization's Frederick Douglass Award for his work in engaging young men to prevent violence against women. And Adrian joins us on the line from Washington. Hi, Adrian. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much. It's Claire. I'm glad to be here with you.
Well, we're glad to have you. And we're also joined by David Lee, Director of Prevention Services for the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. David leads the organization's team that provides training and technical assistance to California's rape crisis centers. He also manages Prevent Connect, the nation's leading online community to advance primary prevention of sexual and domestic violence. And David has been part of the movement to end sexual assault and domestic violence since 1982, and he joins us from Sacramento. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Glad to be joining you today.
Well, it's great to have you. David, let's start off with you. Since you have been involved in this movement since 1982, you have seen a lot. And the issue of sexual violence on college campuses is getting more attention than ever, mostly because so many survivors are bravely speaking out and organizing. But do you think people understand the scope of this issue and just how pervasive it is?
What I have seen in the changes in the last since 1982, or even since some activists first started doing this work in the 1970s, is that now rape is a topic that people are willing to talk about, and people, I think, are starting to acknowledge some of these shifts and changes. I still think we don't know how to talk about it, and we don't know ways that are going to be able to move towards the prevention, but I'm seeing much greater recognition. Today, sexual violence is in the headlines of whether it's the New York Times, whether it's the sports section talking about sports teams, or even on entertainment pages talking about Bill Cosby. So it is a topic now, and this is the moment where we, I believe, can really make changes to lead towards preventing sexual violence.
And we will definitely talk about those changes throughout the hour. But what are your thoughts on this, Andres? Do you think that people understand how pervasive this is?
Well, I agree with David that there is a lot. The media is contributing to raising the awareness about sexual violence, but I think that it's still an under-recognized, under-reported phenomenon. It's under it, and as an example, there's a lot more work to be done, although there's a lot more media attention given to the subject.
And Adrian, I mentioned in the intro about these banners that are getting a lot of attention. The University of Montana removed banners from campus that said, get drunk, get raped. And then a fraternity at Old Dominion University in Virginia has been suspended over banners that said, freshman daughter, drop off, hope your baby girl is ready for a good time. I mean, these guys are doing this in the age of social media, knowing that these banners are probably going to make it on Twitter within seconds of going up. So do you think people understand just the scope of this issue and what we're really dealing with?
I don't
That's the thing. I mean, I think it's getting a lot much more publicity. So it's almost like when it comes to racism and many other isms, right? It's not okay to say these things, but a young man and men still do not understand the complexity of what rape culture really is and really represents. And so if we can remember what rape culture is and as a set of behaviors and attitudes that really encompass and really make rape culture, again, as we talked before, even if we know that only 5% of men are actually doing a lot of this sexual assaults and raping, 95% of the silent men are the ones that uphold and instill rape culture in a sense, because a lot of times they might not really understand or have a gender lens to really understand that some of the things that they're doing, some of the behaviors that attitudes really, really contribute to the bigger issue. So a lot of times, in a sense, that's what we have to, a lot of times, engage men on where they at, to really get them to really understand this part, to really get them to see how this is their issue, and how they need to really advocate not only for women, for young men, for children, but also for themselves, to make sure that this is, you know, and uplift the lives of women and others. That way they could really, really set forth a movement that can really be clear and concise. But that's the big issue that still to this day, we know young men and men might know that it is not okay to catcall, but they don't really understand why not.
Hmm. And so let's talk about that. When you speak with young men about, for example, catcalling, what does that conversation look like? What does it sound like?
So, first of all, we have to talk about healthy and unhealthy masculinity and really have to create a safe space for young men to have this conversation. So a lot of times the conversation is not me saying, do not catcall, but really what is the really show at heart? Where you learn the catcalling from? What gets you to really understand this behavior? We know it's an issue, and let's actually open up for the rest of the people in the room. Other young men to say, okay, do you feel uncomfortable when you catcall? Well, actually, I do. Oh, really? Tell me more about that. Well, you know, I'm doing it because my friends are doing it, but I just thought it was, you know, it's a bad behavior, but I really, maybe I like this person, maybe not. I just didn't learn any better before. I just thought this was the way that I could connect with somebody else at this moment in time. So there are many, many things, but then through this particular questioning and this particular understanding of really getting to the core of why these things, why the learned behavior happen, I'm really getting to realize, oh, wow, this is something that is learned behavior, and this is something that really, really is not only affecting women and affecting young women around me and, you know, my mom and my sister, but another human being. This is also really affecting me and my capabilities to really be seen as another human being just trying to say hello to somebody else. Once that start happen, maybe a shift starts to happen, and we see a lot of young men really figuring out a way to think about gender equity, but other kinds of equity, fighting for other people, because they realize that, you know, they not only the humanity of the people are being compromised, but also their humanity is being compromised.
And it's interesting but not surprising that you say a lot of these young men, boys, say that their friends do it, so they also do it. And David, can you talk a little bit about that, the influences involved with all of these issues? You've got media, you've got peers, community, the tone set by the school, and we'll talk about that a little later in the show. What other influences would you like to raise?
Well, I think that we have to really talk about how we socialize in gender. And I think that Adrian was talking about this and how we raise the concept of what it means to be men and what it means to be boys, and how that includes often in a sense of entitlement, being able to have women and possess women, and that's a big piece of the shift that we are working on, is trying to find ways of looking at how to re-socialize that way. The other factor is often how we train people to say it's not my business in the scope of privacy. And so a lot of our work has been focusing on trying to create people to be active bystanders, to be able to take action when they see something happening that's either contributing to a rape or contributing to creating rape culture, whether it's like catcalling or a joke or what someone's saying, to be able to take action, to be able to talk with their peers. And so we need to break through that sense of it's not my business or I can't do anything, but to say that they can be involved. And those are some of the primary forces that we're working on, to let men know that they can be part of the solution in creating a culture where there's no sexual assault, as opposed to just standing by and letting things happen.
And David, since you've been doing work on this issue since 1982, talk a little bit about the changes that you have seen when people approach this question, what does it mean to be a man?
Well, I think that this work is back in, when I first started doing this work, there were very few men that were talking about the issue. And it was something that men were seeing, that the issue of sexual violence was a women's issue and was holding on to them. And our discussion came, and it's frighteningly the same today, became a discussion about women and what can they do to protect themselves. Instead, we have to focus the conversation on what men can do to be able to not be assaulting people, and what men can do to take responsibility to prevent other men from being able to take that action. And we need to do that shift. What I've seen in the last, particularly the last 10 years, there's been a growing focus on how men can be involved in this work. And some of it's been described as engaging men work, but I think it's more than that. As one of my colleagues at the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault says, that's an awfully low standard just to have men engaged. We need to have men being active in the work. And so the work that Men Can Stop Rape does in, you know, throughout their programs, and actually Andreas's program has implemented some of Men Can Stop Rape's work in their community to be able, working with young men with their My Strength clubs, have been a really great opportunity to be able to start moving forward and advancing the way to have more men involved and more men talking about it. The other change that we're seeing now with the college campus is that we're putting a lot more attention to sports. And we're looking a lot more attention to how male environments, such as fraternities, mm-hmm. are contributing, and how they can also be part of the solutions.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. What about the tone that is set by the college? Because the White House came out with a report last year called Rape and Sexual Assault, A Renewed Call to Action. And it found that there were major failures of criminal justice responses to rape and sexual assault charges across the board, from the police department to the president's office in college. And Inside Higher Ed has an interesting survey looking at 647 college and university presidents, and only 8% of those 647 strongly agreed with the statement, quote, sexual assault is prevalent at U.S. colleges and universities, end quote. So, David, what are your thoughts on the tone that is set by the college or the university?
It is alarming when I hear college administrators say that this is not a problem in their own community. And it's alarming when I see schools that report, they're required by law, all college higher education institutions, to report their number of sexual assaults. And if a college reports zero assaults, then that is an alarming concern, because that's saying not that no rapes are happening. What that is saying is that the college is not creating an environment where people can come forward to talk about the sexual assaults that are taking place on their campus. What I'm also seeing, though, is the beginnings of having ways that universities can play a role in being able to work on shifting that culture and addressing the issue. And I think the leadership that the White House is taking in being able to call for that action, that is going to, is really contributing to being able to shift this. But most importantly, it's been the student activists, as you had said in the introduction of to this hour, it's been the student activists led by survivors and led by students who have said, we must change how a university responds, and that is calling that, and seeing Title IX actions coming against now over 100 colleges in this country is what's driving colleges to be able and universities to see that they must be able to do something, because if they say that this is not a problem, as was done in that survey, then they'll never find a solution.
David Lee is Director of Prevention Services for the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Adrian Valdivia is Manager of National Programs for Men Can Stop Rape. And Andres Matiliano is Executive Director of Community Violence Solutions. And Andres, I wanted to also ask you the same question. How do you think the tone set by the college and how serious it takes this issue affects the way young men view this issue?
Well, I agree with both David and Adrian. You know, the Old Dominion example is a perfect example. that it's not taking, the college campuses don't take this issue seriously. You know, in Old Dominion's case, they suspended the fraternity immediately, but the fact that the fraternity thought that it was even acceptable to put those messages out there is absolutely appalling. And I want to, you know, go back, because the attitudes of the colleges themselves are a reflection, I think, of just our society in general. And if you're looking at prevention, and you need to look at primary prevention, which means that you're preventing violence before it ever occurs, you need to look at it on an ecological level, on four levels, looking both at the risk and the protective factors. You have to look at the individual responsibility. You have to look for programming that's going to influence how one's personal beliefs, one's attitudes, and one's knowledge, and then their behavior. You also have to look at the relationship. We live in relationships with one another, so we need to look at curriculum in schools that teaches our young men and women how to act towards each other, creating relationships that are rooted in mutual respect, addressing dating violence and putting an end, you know, saying that that's not acceptable. Then you have to look at the third level, which is community. And these prevention strategies aim to influence the climate and the environment in which students spend the most time. And this is where schools really have the potential to be significant change agents. They have to take ownership to create climate where violence of any kind isn't tolerated. And as an example, just here in West Contra Costa County, Unified School District, they are committed to an initiative called the Full Service Schools Initiative, where the schools then become the hub of the community. And part of that is creating a climate of safety where folks are encouraged to come forward, where there's a sense of welcoming and safety, and youth can come forward not only to express their experiences as victims, but as David said, to become allies and active bystanders, so that they, young men, can speak up and become leaders in the community and influence their peers to stop the violence before it ever begins. And then on the fourth level is on the societal level. And these are strategies that promote the widespread social changes. And an example of that campaign is the No More campaign, which gained national recognition, I think, during the Super Bowl. The NFL promoted it. This is a campaign that seeks to bring awareness to domestic and sexual violence. And what you see are individuals, you see celebrities, and then you see individuals just making very simple, poignant statements. No more, it's your fault. No more, but I love him. No more, he promised he won't do it again. No more, you know, statements like that that are truly impactful. They're succinct, and yet they carry a deep, deep message. And Contra Costa actually produced its own No More campaign, its own No More video, highlighting the voices of people right here in our own community.
Today on Your Call, we are talking about effective anti-rape and anti-sexual assault education for men and young boys. And we'd love to hear from you. What do you think is most effective? How do you talk to the men and young boys in your life? Or if you had some training or you dealt with these issues when you were in school, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What do you think is most effective? How do we reach young boys, for example, before they enter high school? How do we reach young men in fraternities who hang banners that say get drunk and get raped? What are your thoughts on this? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. I also wanted to mention that we invited UC Berkeley. They said that they were too busy to join. UC Santa Cruz, UC Davis, and they were too busy. We just received a message from San Francisco State saying this is our first week of instruction for the fall semester, which requires all hands on deck here on our main campus. Therefore, we can't participate. Our men's program covering Title IX issues is currently in development. We hope you'll reach out to us next year when the program is in operation. The U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights is currently investigating 124 colleges and universities and 40 elementary and secondary schools. These colleges in California include UC Berkeley, UC Davis, UCLA, UC San Francisco, UC Santa Cruz, almost all of them, the University of Southern California. So what are your thoughts on effective education for young men and boys? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Andres, what about the question of really trying to reach out to young boys before they even enter high school? I understand that Community Violence Solutions runs a program targeting boys age starting at age 14. What would you say is age appropriate about the, when it comes to these issues?
Well, I would say that we actually need to target even earlier than 14. And we start our prevention program as early as first grade. We use a curriculum in first grade, starting in first grade, called Second Step. And it starts with bullying prevention. There's a study out of the Midwest that, of middle schools, that suggests that bullying and homophobic teasing are significant predictors of sexual harassment perpetration over time. So that you, if you're starting in middle school at age 14, you've kind of missed a window. So you need to start earlier with age-appropriate messages around bullying. And our curriculum, the second step and then the middle school stepping in, it focuses on those kinds of messages. And as the youth get older, first grade, third grade, fifth grade, the curriculum and then the dialogue becomes more sophisticated and richer. And, you know, our agency believes that it's not a one-time thing. You have to use what is called a saturation model, where they see us in the classrooms for 4 weeks, and then again in the third grade for 4 weeks, and the fifth grade, and in the fifth grade for 4 weeks, so that the message, they really have the opportunity to kind of grapple with the message and see how it kind of fits in with their own beliefs. And we have the opportunity to influence rather than just a one-time workshop. And then, as you mentioned, as the youth get a little bit older, you're able to engage them to become leaders. It's not just, okay, here's the information, think about it on an individual level. Here you are, here you have the opportunity to be a leader in your own community and to take action, as Adrian and David said, to stop the behavior. To see if you're witnessing behavior, that you're able to, safely in some way intervene. You don't just accept it. And then also take an active part in promoting the prevention aspects of violence. Mm-hmm.
And just quickly, how much buy-in do you get from schools? Because Mother Jones recently reported that in the U.S., sex education is legally mandated, and only 22 states and just 13 require that information be medically accurate.
I think that we get buy-in from the schools. We have an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, with the entire West Contra Costa School District to provide this prevention curriculum. I think the challenge is that there isn't a financial investment in order for us to do that. Funding for prevention is extremely limited. It would be my dream come true if all of us at Community Violence worked ourselves out of a job, because there would be no more need for us to provide services to victims.
Well, Andres, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. Today we are talking about the best ways to reach boys and young men when it comes to issues of sexual violence and rape. According to the Washington Post, 20% of young women, 5% of men who attend college during the past 4 years say they were sexually assaulted. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. To join in today's conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-TALK. Again, it's a toll-free number. If you'd prefer to write rather than call your question in, the email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. Following that at noon, Ira Glass in This American Life. And at 1 o'clock, Glenn Washington's Snap Judgment.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the growing interest in agriculture investments. Why are Wall Street investors buying so much farmland? In 2009, investors made up a quarter of Iowa farmland purchases. In Africa, the demand is very high. Investors are buying millions of acres in Ethiopia, Mozambique, and Sudan. So what does this mean for rural communities and the global food system? That's tomorrow. Friday, it's our media roundtable. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line. feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about effective anti-rape and anti-sexual assault education for men and young boys. This issue, especially the issue of rape and sexual assault on college campuses, is getting so much attention now, thanks to people who've been raped, who are bravely speaking out and organizing. We did a show about the amazing documentary The Hunting Ground, which takes a look at this issue. And that you can find that at yourcallradio.org and watch that documentary, because so many people bravely talk about what they went through and how they're dealing with it. And today we are talking about these issues with Adrian Valdivia, manager of National Programs for Men Can Stop Rape, David Lee, director of prevention services for the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and Andres Maltiliano, executive director of Community Violence Solutions. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And quickly, before we get to calls, Andres, before the break, you were saying that, gosh, if we just had the funding we needed to, you know, go into schools and talk to people in the first grade, then maybe you'd be out of a job today. How much are you talking about? Like, what are you looking for per year? How much would it cost to fund a program like that?
Oh, my goodness. How much would it cost to fund a program? Well, to do it to the scope that I would want. So my agency serves all of Contra Costa County. Our funding right now is limited to essentially West County. So if I were to think about all of Contra Costa, and we also serve Marin, we also do prevention and intervention work in Marin County, I would be looking at several hundreds of thousands of dollars, because I would want intervention, I would want education specialists in every school. Hmm. I would want them, I would want every single child to get this curriculum and to have this opportunity to think about violence, sexual violence, and violence in this way. And I don't believe that that happens. There are schools that have more some programming, but not every school has programming. And right now, the programming is targeting sort of the highest risk areas. But it doesn't mean that just because, you know, you have an affluent community in your county, that that community and the children in that community don't need the same opportunities.
Right. Well, we have a number of callers on the line, so let's hear from Natanya in San Francisco. Hi, Natanya. Welcome to the show. Tanya wanted to talk about how porn is contributing to rape culture. And David, again, you've been working on these issues since 1982, and the level of the easy access to hardcore porn today is very different from even 10 years ago. So can you talk about those changes that you've seen and how you think that contributes to rape culture?
Right. Well, we see actually the earliest work done in the San Francisco Bay Area was actually educating men about porn and the impact of porn, and how pornography messages reinforce that men are controlling women, that women are objects to be possessed, and that we can and that is a lot of the mainstream porn that we see from then, and it is of course exacerbated and become much more available now. So porn is one part of often how men learn about sexuality, and it's you talked about earlier how while sex ed is being required, how often it is not being taught, or if it's being taught, how little is being taught. In that in many ways pornography has served as our sex education, mm-hmm. and what it is a total injustice, because what it doesn't do is be able to talk about how do we form respectful relationships. It doesn't talk about how we create consent. It does not talk about how we can be able to engage with people. Instead, it's treating people as objects. So what we want to do is find those alternatives to be able to educate people in shifting, moving forward to prevent sexual violence.
And Adrian, what would you add to that? Again, for people who might not know, I mean, it's very, very easy now to access very violent pornography with the click of a button.
Well, I think I agree completely with what David's talking about. And by the way, hi, David. How are you? How is well over there? I think continuing this conversation, I think that's one of the main issues. You know, I'm thinking of, I was a health educator for a long time in DC public schools, and this is one of the main issues that we had. I mean, a lot of young men were accessing porn before actually talking about negotiation skills. And we have to remember, a lot of times pornography is actually something, it's kind of like a Hollywood version of what sexual interaction could be. So it's really not the reality, but this is what the reality of a lot of the young men are looking at. And they're thinking, they're taking these images of dominance and so on to think that this is actually real, to think that this is. And so, of course, it contributes hugely to rape culture and to these ideas. I mean, you know, so I'm thinking about consent, and as David was talking about also, and also about negotiating, you know, what, you know, and talk and having those conversations. Even have a conversation about condom use or not condom use and so on, and these things do not happen through porn. This, and to tell you too, during popular culture, even in our soap operas and so on, we don't have this kind of conversations. So it's not only it's not only porn per se, but it's also the dominant stories that come up in the news, the dominant stories that come up even in our movies, in our the television sets that we see. We don't see any kind of public education or any kind of health education really taught through these things. And people watch these mainstream things all the time, but those things also have an effect, and they don't hold rape culture in so many ways. Even if they might be subtle and they might not be as big, but they do also, because they sort of advertise an idea of this particular masculinity, dominant masculinity that we're sort of accustomed to.
Well, thank you again for the phone call, and let's go next to Doug in San Francisco. Hi, Doug. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Whenever this discussion comes up, we're always getting statistics on campus. And I'm wondering if there are any statistics about young people who don't go to college. Are we saying that it's more dangerous to go to college than not, that a college dorm room is a more dangerous environment than a basement apartment or the back seat of a car or a pickup truck? And how would you reach the young population that is not on a college campus to educate them?
Well, thank you for that. David, do you have those numbers? What are the stats for young people who are not in college?
This is David Lee. There was a study that was done by the Bureau of Justice Statistics where they did look using the National Crime Victimization Survey, comparing college students to non-college students, and they found that actually of the same age level that the rates were slightly higher for people who did not attend college. Now, that's a little bit of a limited survey because of the way they asked the questions. So I think the caller makes a good point that people are at risk regardless of whether they go to college. What we focus about colleges is that there are certain policies and procedures that colleges have an opportunity to be able to prevent these from happening that might not happen in other settings. And so we want to be able to make sure that colleges can be able to take that action and that there is a risk at college, though there is also a risk for people that don't attend college.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. And on that question, there have been some changes, major changes at universities, even though we saw that recent study about how only 8% of presidents of universities believe this is a pervasive issue. And in Texas, the Huffington Post wrote about this, the University of Texas is going to launch the largest study of campus sexual assault ever conducted. It's a $1.7 million study. 400,000 sexual assaults occurred last year in Texas. Only 9% were reported to law enforcement. So, David, are you seeing many major changes like this, or at least efforts on the ground?
We are seeing a lot more looking at studying and doing this. In the White House report that they put out last year, they called on all college campuses to do climate surveys. And so there's a host of different types of climate surveys that are going on. So we've also seen MIT release this, University of Oregon. There's been many of them that we've seen around the country that are starting to release findings. So we're having a lot more exploration in doing this. The challenge we have is that how do we find a way that's actually going to go to create real change? Many campuses are trying to find their solution in a box and find the easiest solution. Can we educate people by doing a one-hour online unit to be able to prevent sexual violence? Mm-hmm. That might be helpful as a start, but it's not sufficient. And that we need to come up with, to create effective change, we have to come up with long-term efforts. We need to come up with efforts that are going to be able to be working with students in a to help support them to become active, to be able to create change. We need to start before college because students, as you had shared at the beginning, how many students have been sexually assaulted before the age of 18. We need to find ways to leverage programs like sports and find ways to get, you know, in the way that they interact with youth to include these messages of sexual violence prevention to be able to create that change. Hmm.
David Lee is Director of Prevention Services for the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. He leads the organization's team that provides training and technical assistance to California's rape crisis centers. Adrian Valdivia is Manager of National Programs for Men Can Stop Rape. And Andres Maltiliano is Executive Director of Community Violence Solutions. Today, we are talking about the most effective ways to reach young men and boys when it comes to rape and sexual assault. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. What do you think are the most effective ways? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we have an email from Karen who says, if parents don't teach their sons when they're small that they are not the center of the universe and that respect for other people is critical, I don't think anybody else has a decent chance to do it. And we have a related caller. Let's go to JT in Santa Cruz. Hi, JT. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. So I just like to point out that, like, we're from the very beginning making differences of privilege with men and women by letting boys walk around half naked. Everyone feels better half naked, but, like, we're deciding as a society their comfort is more important than half the, you know, the other half of the population. It's like grown men need to stop taking their shirts off in public, and women and mothers need to stop making these, like, initial differences in the sexes, because all it does is end up being an excuse to have more privilege in the society.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. So what are your thoughts, Adrian, about the question around privilege and then Karen's point that parents really need to teach their sons when they're small that respect for other people is critical?
Yeah, I think that's a little much more complex part. I think that gender socialization starts before the womb. And The part about really getting, especially men, I want to make sure that, you know, we're still thinking about men as rape as a men's issue and sexual assault as a men's issue. So I think for our socialization, we have to really understand that the gender norms that are common sometimes those things are set in a way in which really uphold this particular culture of rape. So we have to really tackle those things. And maybe, you know, as the caller is talking about, I think there's some truth about that, but at the same time, the part is not only about the stuff that I shared, but about many, many other things that uphold that part of the culture. And the culture specifically of privilege, and male privilege in this case. So it could be as little as open a door for somebody of their gender, all the way to really thinking of women at this particular group of people or less than, all the way to calling a boy, another boy, the B word, to try to make fun of him. All those things sort of contribute to the to what rape culture looks like, and uphold sort of the sense of privilege for men, and they say that they can get away with this or they can get away with that, and for young men to the persuasion for them is to really to get them to understand that even if there is a privilege there is a sense of confining your humanity and confining who you are. That even if there's a privilege, you would not be able to really find the kind of relationships with other men and with other women that you really want for your life. And that's the part about healthy and unhealthy masculinity, that even if those things you know, have privilege, and that unhealthy masculinity is something that is very much part of Hollywood and part of many, many things in the world, and that you see those things are not really going to get you to help you to really have the life that you really want and the things that you really want in your life, and to really to really have the kind of relationships in your life that you do want to have.
It would be interesting to follow what happens at Old Dominion University, where a fraternity was just suspended over the banners that said freshman daughter drop off, hope your baby girl is ready for a good time. What are your thoughts about how the school should deal with something like that, Andres, because you've done so much work in schools? How do you reach these young men who hang banners that say, you know, get drunk, get raped?
Well, I think that there is an opportunity to take these young men, and maybe this is, I'm very idealistic, but to sort of intervene. It's an opportunity to intervene and interrupt the cycle and have the young men step forward as leaders in their own community. But kind of going to what David and Adrian are talking about the privilege, male privilege. Male privilege is, it's overt, but it's also insidious in so many ways. As an example, this morning when I was driving to work, I turned on the radio, and the particular host was talking about the cheating website Ashley Madison, and he pointed out the women that use the website, and he used some derogatory terminology about the women that use this website, calling them cheating, you know, I'm not going to repeat his language because it's derogatory, but he never mentioned the men that use the website. Hmm. So the fact that he, you know, was calling out the women and not even acknowledging that men use that website is an example of sort of how ingrained these ideas are in our culture that promote male dominance, that promote the objectification of women, and that promote the sexual gender-based violence.
And people used Ashley Madison to have affairs, and recently 37 million users' personal information was leaked by hackers, just to let people know about that. What would you add to that, David, talking about privilege and how, you know, how to best tackle that issue?
Well, I think this comes back to the issue of looking at privilege and looking at gender and looking at, we also need to look at the linkages to race and to class. But we have to be able to recognize that we live in a society that privileges men, and that privileging leads to a sense of entitlement, has often leads to a sense of entitlement, and that leads to a sense where then it becomes acceptable for these men to put up these banners. I love Andrea's idea, and I've had experience in doing this work of finding men and finding a way to have them look at how they can be part of the solution. Identify where they're contributing to the privilege, but then finding ways to interrupt it. Finding ways that they can go over, because it would be most powerful if not just having other people pointed out, but if we had members of their own community. There were undoubtedly men in that fraternity who were unhappy with what that was going on, but they didn't say anything. Mm-hmm. So how do we find a way to empower them to be able to take action? How do we get other members of the Greek fraternity community to do this? We've seen in the last year several national Greek fraternities against rape and sexual assault organizations form. How can they go over and be able to start a narrative to be able to say that we find this unacceptable and we are going to use our position as leaders in the community to say that this is not acceptable? That's a way to be able to sort of take that privilege that men have in our society, but use it as a force to be able to make a change for good.
And so you go from the case of the fraternities, athletes. We're getting a couple of emails about how athletes are dealt with. Natalie says, I had a friend in college that never got justice for their rapes because the athletes were so protected by the athletic department and had so much to lose. Do you see this as a big problem nationwide, and how is this being tackled? Adrian, do you want to take that one? The question about athletes was also raised in the documentary The Hunting Ground.
Could you repeat the question again?
Yeah. So Natalie wanted to know, what about college athletes? some of her friends in college were raped, but they never got justice because the athletes were protected by the athletic department, and the department had a lot to lose by going after the athletes.
Yeah, I think, well, so right now we actually, Office of Violence Against Women, and Department of Justice, we're actually working on certain initiatives to start actually engaging men on in athletics. And so actually, as David Lee was pointing, and we're doing work around really getting systemic work, basically actually talking to athletic directors, talking to the coaches, and figuring out ways where we can actually implement a lot of curriculum that talks about healthy masculinity, really understanding and getting a crack at a rape culture in a sense before we even talk to a lot of the athletes. So we engage in student leaders and the women's center in those college in these different colleges in the U.S. And really getting at a point where they could actually start having a conversation and really getting to understand that even within those departments within those departments there are things that they can do to make sure that they actually combat these things, because we've heard all about what locker room talk looks like. We've heard what misogynism looks like within sometimes at the athletic community in campuses, yet and at the same time we know at the same time that there are actually many young men who happen to be athletes that do not subscribe to those things, but could not find a voice to talk about these things. So how do we uplift those voices and say, you know, actually some of the athletes and some of the young men in campuses actually are not okay with this. They're very uncomfortable about rape culture, about this particular way, so how parties are handled and all these things that happen, about some of the men within the teams getting away with all these things that are happening. We just had, for example, and this is very interesting because, you know, we have somebody like Chris Carter that came up from the Minnesota Vikings about a couple of days ago talking about having a fall guy, and that's sort of the male privilege mentality about having a fall guy. But the same thing, it happens a lot of times in colleges. The idea, the coach is going to protect me from this. My team is going to protect me from this. But how do we get out of the mentality and say, okay, this is what we need to do in order to make sure that not only the team is safe, but everyone in campus is safe.
And again, that goes back to the tone that is set by the college. Is the college going to actually take this seriously? And we have just a couple minutes left, but from colleges to high schools, I also, Andres, wanted you to talk about the experience you had at Richmond High School. This was a horrific case that happened in 2009. The victim, identified as Jane Doe, was raped and beaten for more than 2 hours in a dark high school courtyard. And as she was being abused and raped, people were chanting, they were laughing, they were encouraging the attackers, and no one called the police. I mean, the horrific all around, because I understand that, six men have been charged? Is that right?
And there's convictions in that case now as well. I wasn't personally with the organization at the time, but I can speak to our experience. We were involved with the case subsequent to the rape, and what happened is that actually opened the doors to our agency to access all of West Contra Costa Unified School District. The schools really had no choice after such an event but to allow us to come in, and now we have widespread access. But that speaks to, you know, how much we need to develop that personal sense of accountability in individuals to give folks the sense of duty, men and women, to stand up when they see something like that. David talked about the work, the bystander work. And David, maybe you can talk a little bit about the My Strength program, because that is we use that in our high school to develop leaders and allies. And it's a curriculum that was developed by CalCasa that we've used with some success. And we're proud of it.
Andres, can I ask you, when this happened, it was horrific, but what I found was that most of the people commenting on the article about this young girl They all said throw these people in jail for the rest of their lives, and some of these boys are actually going to get life sentences. But very few people actually said, why did they do this? Mm-hmm. How would 10 boys do something like this and then others watch and not call the police? Well, was that question answered and discussed in schools?
Well, you know, there still is. We're getting better at talking about sex, but we're still very uncomfortable with it. And there still is a culture of victim blaming and slut shaming. And that's part of that. That's part of the conversation that needs to happen. And that and the fact that no one thought about it from, you know, everybody can say, oh, yes, it's horrible. But no one really thought about, well, why did this happen in the first place?
Right.
And I would imagine that there was plenty of conversations around, well, she probably, you know, she probably brought it on herself. She was, you know, whatever reason, she was intoxicated or she was wearing something that, you know, made her, you know, that seemed like she was asking for it. We still hear those things. Even today, after all of the attention, after all of the work that's going on to sort of change that, women still get those messages that it's our responsibility to protect ourselves, as David said earlier, rather than, you know, stopping the violence before it ever begins.
But thanks to the people who are sexually assaulted or raped who are speaking out and demanding change, would you say that things are slowly starting to change?
Are they starting to change? Honestly, not as much as I would like to see them change. We still get nearly 1,000 calls to our crisis line every single year. Nearly 50% of the folks we work with are minors, and heartbreaking.
Well, we would love to do a show about the work that you're doing in high school, so we'll definitely be in touch. Andres Maltiliano is Executive Director of Community Violence Solutions. Adrian Valdivia is Manager of National Programs for Men Can Stop Rape. And David Lee is with the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Thank you all for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Why are Wall Street investors buying farmland? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the growing interest in agriculture investments. Investors made up nearly a quarter of Iowa farmland purchases in 2009. In Africa, the demand is especially high, with investors buying millions of acres in Ethiopia, Mozambique, and Sudan. So what does this mean for rural communities and the global food system? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.